Now, people across the country watched and waited Tuesday for the jury's ruling on former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd. One of those watching was our next guest, who says the jury's guilty ruling was right, but he says this should just be the start of efforts around police reform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you watching for that verdict? What was your reaction? Do you think changes are needed when it comes to American policing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. James E. Causey is a columnist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab. He wrote a recent opinion piece talking about the Chauvin verdict. James, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, what was your reaction, James, on Tuesday when this long-awaited verdict came down?
Actually, I was a bit surprised, but not totally surprised. I was thinking that if there was ever a case where a police officer was going to be found guilty on all counts, this had to be the case. I mean, the videotape, the 9 minutes plus on this man's neck for a counterfeit $20 bill that we don't even know if he knew it was a counterfeit bill or not. It just seems like if justice wasn't going to be found on this case, I don't think justice could ever be found on any case.
In the piece I mentioned, you talked about how this relates to what you've seen in Milwaukee. You talked to some other people in Milwaukee communities. What's on your mind when it comes to Milwaukee after that verdict now?
Well, Milwaukee still has a long ways to go, like most major urban cities. I mean, there needs to be a better relationship between the community and police officers and law enforcement in general. Law enforcement has to show respect to citizens, and citizens also have to respect officers as well. It's a mutual thing that needs to take place. We always talk about relationships between law enforcement and the community, but it only comes up when something bad happens. It never comes up when things are good. And right now, this is a time for action and a time to have those hard conversations about when a person is stopped. It's time to have conversations about the use of force in certain cases. And it's time to have real conversation about what real reform looks like.
We've seen a couple catchphrases come out a lot over the last year, James. In some protests, some people had the phrase, all cops are bad. Also, there's the idea that, hey, there's a few bad apples. We got one in this case, but in general, things are okay. You're not comfortable, if I'm reading you right, with either of those.
No, I mean, I have several friends of mine who believe that there's no such thing as a good cop. And I think they come to that conclusion because, and it's like, if we just look at the George Floyd case, there were officers there who could have done more to stop this from turning into a death scene. They didn't do anything. They stood by and watched and participated in holding Mr. Floyd down. And so even though Chauvin was the only one charged with three guilty counts, I'm saying that the other officers are just as guilty for not stepping up and just pulling Chauvin off of his neck. I mean, that didn't take much effort to say, hey, that's enough. Hey, partner, that's enough. We have a case right now. I don't know if you've seen the video where this officer started punching this lady, this handcuffed woman in the face. He punched her twice and one of his fellow officers grabbed him and stopped him. That's what we need to see. We need to see officers when their partner is going too far, stepping in and protecting a person from an officer and also preventing a large lawsuit. I mean, these lawsuits are costing taxpayers millions and millions of dollars. And I just don't understand that. That needs to change right away.
Talking to James Causey, columnist of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about his reactions to the Derek Chauvin verdict in Minneapolis and looking ahead at policing in Milwaukee and beyond. And James, you also wrote that you had a conversation with a friend who said George Floyd would be alive if he had complied with police from the start of that encounter. That's something we hear from callers from time to time as well. What do you make of that argument?
Well, what I make of that argument is I call BS on that, because we've seen cases where people have complied or they've been too scared to do exactly what officer is saying to do. You know, you have one officer scream, put your hands up, and another guy scream, put your hands on your steering wheel, do blah, 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 blah. You know, how are we supposed to react when you have all these people screaming at you? You know, the case with the lieutenant, for instance, the guy that was in the SUV where he got pepper sprayed by the two officers. You know, the officers are screaming at him, and this guy is a lieutenant with the U.S. Army. He said, I'm scared right now. You guys are pointing guns at me. I don't know what to do. And they were like, well, get out of the car. Get out of the car. Undo your seatbelt. And he didn't want to move his hands because he knows what happens when people of color make sudden movements or appear to be reaching. That could be a life or death sentence, and it shouldn't be like that.
You drove to the George Floyd Memorial in Minneapolis. What was that experience like for you?
Man, I got to tell you, that was life-changing. My wife and I, we decided to go see for ourselves what it looked like. And it was, honestly, it was somber. It was very quiet, even though there were a lot of people at the scene. People were very respectful and just walked like, it was almost like you were walking in a graveyard because you had all these names written on the street and of people who lost their lives to law enforcement officers and in those kind of cases. And then you had all these poetic sayings all around. And then you had these pictures of George Floyd, flowers and things like that. It was like, it was almost like being at a cemetery, a large 3-block long cemetery. And I don't think I would ever forget that. Some people were crying. A lot of people took pictures, but it's something I'd never forget.
You mentioned the idea of police and communities getting along better, police treating community members with respect and community members treating police with respect. But a lot of times, I don't know, it seems like we fall into an us versus them mentality on a lot of issues, much less police community relationships. Do you have thoughts on ways, and I think I've talked to you about this in the past, James, do you have thoughts on ways to start building that relationship that doesn't start with that it's us against you mindset?
Well, I think it gets back to community policing. It gets back to officers being in communities, talking with people, and really getting to know who these people are. You know, one of the biggest problems that we have in our city is that nearly half of the officers who live in Milwaukee or who work for the Milwaukee Police Department don't live in the city. So when you don't live in the city, you don't shop in the city, your kids don't go to school in the city, you live in the burbs or somewhere else, then how can you really have a true connection to the city? I know some officers will argue, yeah, I could do that, and it doesn't bother me. But I argue that if you're connected to the city and it's a city job, it's Milwaukee Police Department, that to me, that job belongs to the people of Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee. So you should live in the city that you serve. So when they changed that rule, when the Walker administration and they pushed to change that rule, I think it really hurt relationships between police officers and the community a lot more than a lot of people would even know.
A lot of talk about police reform now, James, at the federal level, the state level, local governments. It can mean a lot of different things. What would be at the top of your list for priorities?
One thing, I think officers' pensions should be the first thing that they should lose. I don't think you should be allowed to kill someone and still collect your pension. I don't think taxpayers should be responsible for bad officers doing what they do. You know, it's like I say, it costs millions and millions of dollars to taxpayers when an officer commits a bad act and they're just wrong. And to me, why should the citizens, a lot of them are people of color, be punished for that? I don't want to pay for an officer's bad decision. An officer should have to pay for their own bad decision. Now, I think another thing that needs to happen when we talk about defunding the police, I think a lot of people get upset about that. What that really means is taking some of that money, because some of these police budgets are up to 60% of the city's budget. Think about that. You're taking 60% of the city's budget and the crime is still spiking. Homicides are still spiking. And then just to maintain what you have, not to improve, but just to maintain, you still need an increase to the police budget. That makes absolutely no sense. Why would you give money to someone and say, hey, I want you to wash my car, and you give them a dollar to wash your car, but they half wash your car, and then they come back to you later and say, okay, I need more money to really clean the rims this time. And then you say, wait, I gave you the full amount to wash my car. But that's what the police department keeps doing. They keep asking for more money, and they keep getting it, and things are not getting better. So we got to try a different way.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thank you.
That's James Causey with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, columnist there with us today to talk about his latest opinion piece. The jury got the Chauvin verdict right this time is the headline, but this should be the only beginning of police reform. Up next, we'll continue the conversation about policing after the Chauvin verdict. A former federal prosecutor joins the show to talk about a federal investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department and the revival of some kinds of federal oversight of local police departments. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more federal oversight, see federal officials be more aggressive looking into local police departments? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about police reform following the conviction of Derek Chauvin. The U.S. Department of Justice announced an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department's practices this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions about what the federal government does when it comes to oversight over local police departments. If you'd like to see more of that, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Cammie Chavis is Vice Provost, Professor of Law, and Director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University. She's also a former federal prosecutor. Cammie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to listen to a little audio of Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing this week an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department.
The investigation I am announcing today will assess whether the Minneapolis Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of using excessive force, including during protests.
Cammie, can you tell us about this kind of pattern or practice investigation from the federal government? What goes into something like that?
Yes, well, the authority for these types of investigations began in 1994. We had just actually come off of the horrific beating of Rodney King, and there was an idea that it's not just one bad apple or two bad apples, but that police misconduct, the root of it, can be systemic, can be organizational. And so how do you address organizational police misconduct? The federal government has this authority now to go in and investigate what's happening in Minneapolis.
And one particular item that's been reported on here looks into the original statement from the department, the police department of Minneapolis, after Floyd's death, which omitted a lot of detail and was inaccurate. How significant would it be if the investigation reveals that that's a pattern, misrepresenting the events that happened in these kind of incidents?
Yes. So it's very important. That's exactly what this investigation will look at. We'll look at patterns. It's not one single incident. As horrific as the events surrounding Mr. Floyd's death are, that alone wouldn't necessarily be sufficient to connote a pattern. But yes, if there were multiple instances of that, mostly what these investigations are focused on would be the uses of force, training. Is there a lack of training? Or do officers in that department receive proper training? There'll be a comprehensive review of internal police policies, procedures, as well as how the department handles their complaints. Some of the previous investigations have revolved around racial profiling, so that may or may not be an issue here. So there are a lot of different things that that the investigation may cover, and it's really promising to see these federal investigations begin again.
Another phrase that's come up now related to the federal government looking at local police departments is the consent decree. We heard about them a lot more before the Trump administration. They put them on the back burner or mostly stopped them. We've had consent decrees, for example, in Milwaukee, I believe. What is a consent decree, Cammie, and how does it work?
Yes. So a consent decree is a judicially enforceable agreement or set of recommendations. And so how these investigations work, let's say, for example, that a pattern or practice of unlawful behavior was found in any local police department. the DOJ, the executives from the city, executives from the police department, and community members, and hopefully rank and file police officers through the unions. Hopefully, everyone would think about what's best in terms of reform. And there's a judicially enforceable consent decree that would contain different reforms. It may be things like keeping, and just to give you some examples from other consent decrees, it may be that you need to keep track of the race in terms of racial profiling. It may mean that you have to revamp your use of force policies. It may mean that you need to identify problem officers. And I think that that could be an issue in Minneapolis, because we know that, for example, Derek Chauvin had many complaints against him. And if there's a pattern of multiple officers with multiple complaints and no discipline or retraining or anything like that, that could be a significant issue. That would be something that you would want to remedy. Let's find those officers and deal with them in some way. So there's a variety of things that, and again, an investigation will be important to think about any recommendations specific to Minneapolis that would be included in a consent decree.
Talking to Cami Chavis from Wake Forest University, former federal prosecutor, looking at federal interventions in local police departments, things like pattern and practice reviews happening soon in Minneapolis, and consent decrees, which have happened in a number of cities, the Biden administration reopening the door to those. All right, Cami, in principle, I think I get how these things work. In practice, is it really that easy for some federal officials to come in and actually make meaningful changes in the culture and practices of a local police department?
So, you know, they can be. I think that the having the investigation, having this legislation, the authority is important, because if Minneapolis, for example, we know what happened in Minneapolis, and now if Minneapolis is subject to this pattern or practice investigation, the hope would be that other local police departments around the nation, and we know there are 18,000 local police departments, but that they might say, okay, well, I don't want the federal government to come here, so let me go ahead and let's fix our practices. But these consent decrees, if you look at the entire body, and there have been dozens of these since 1994, if you were to look at them, they really give you a good idea about principles that promote police integrity and promote accountability. And so they are a wealth of information. There have been a few studies. I think the hardest part about, and it's a cautionary tale here, is that we were expecting immediate reform. And I think one critique of this authority is the way that, this can be a lengthy investigation. And then depending on what the reforms are, there could be some time to make sure that those are fully implemented.
With just about any issue we could name, Cami, there's a debate over how much the federal government should be involved versus state or local governments. When it comes to overseeing local police departments, what do you see as the value of having at least some federal role in the kind of practices we're talking about?
Yes, and I think it's really interesting. You mentioned this earlier that the Trump administration had stepped back from this enforcement, and really, Jeff Sessions and Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Attorney General former Attorney General Jeff Sessions and William Barr were openly hostile, really, to this type of involvement. And it is a big deal when you have the federal government that comes along to work with a local government. And it's how it's perceived. Are they working with the local entities? My understanding is that in Minneapolis, the city council welcomed this investigation because of the benefits that might come from it. But yes, I think that there are a number of different things. The city may not have the resources to do this type of investigation and to make the reforms on their own, to know what's required. So it can be helpful in that way, but it's really going to require the cooperation of the local authorities there, and it should also be done in conjunction with the community and with the rank and file police officers. And my understanding is that the Justice Department understands that, and that they have already spoken to community groups, and so that should not be an issue here.
So we've got this pattern and practice review coming to Minneapolis. Do you expect, now that consent decrees are back under the table with current Attorney General Merrick Garland, do you expect to see more of these, maybe even lots of these in the next couple few years?
Well, the problem with, and this is, again, one critique of this federal authority, is that Attorney General Garland is but one man, one Justice Department. And as I said, there are 18,000 local police departments, many of which could use some assistance. So the Justice Department, even though the federal government, it does have limited resources. So we will see, I'm sure that we will see more investigations than we saw with the Trump administration. But to say that we will see, you know, we're not going to see hundreds. We're not going to see that. Just that there's not the resources to do that. That's why it's important. I do know that some states are looking at enacting analogous legislation at the state level. And so then that way, again, you could have not just the federal attorney general, but you could have state attorney generals who are performing some of the same investigations and making recommendations at a state level.
We'll leave it there. Cammie, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Cammie Chavis, former federal prosecutor, currently the director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University. She was with us today to talk about the Biden administration's revival of consent decrees and what to expect in a federal investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department.